Speaking of the golem, she was supposed to be here ordering supplies, and yet she was nowhere to be seen. In fairness, though, this place was a lot bigger than the orders office. About the size of an extra-large barn, to be precise. Fizzy might simply have gone into one of the several workshops on the premises. Deciding to ask around, Boxy approached one of the unoccupied clerks, a middle-aged dwarf wearing half-moon spectacles and a clean white and gray striped shirt. He was busy scribbling at something behind his desk and didn't seem to notice the ginger elf's approach.
"Hello there,"
the shapeshifter greeted the gentleman in an effort to get his attention.
"Whoa, hello, sir,"
the man responded.
"What can I help you with?" "I'm looking for a steel golem. Looks like a female gnome. Has a shield attached to her left hand."
"Who's asking?"
"I am."
The man appeared supremely unamused.
"Don't be a smartass. Just give me your name, lad."
"Oh, Chester Underwood."
"Ah, you're the owner it mentioned. Fine piece of equipment you got there, if you don't mind me saying."
"Thanks, but can you tell me where she is?"
"Should be through those doors over there."
He pointed to the far left of the lobby.
"Our smiths are currently fulfilling your order and insisted on observing them. Should be a bit longer before they're done."
The order in question was for artificer parts. An entire crate's worth. They were necessary for Boxy's tinkering practice, so it had told Fizzy to have plenty made as quickly as possible. Though it had told the gate guard that it would linger for a few days, it ideally wanted to be in and out as quickly as possible.
"I'll leave that to her, then,"
the false elf declared.
"Meanwhile, I'd like to have some things appraised."
"Oh, what kind?"
"Magic items. From a dungeon."
"Really?"
The dwarf raised an eyebrow.
"Dungeon diving? At your age?"
"I had strong allies."
"Fair enough. We actually have a few people available who can take care of that."
"Any of them not human?"
The clerk sighed in exasperation, though he certainly understood why racial tensions between elves and humans existed. That didn't mean that he particularly liked it.
"Hold on. I'll call them over."
He pushed a button on his desk, and a buzzing noise came from somewhere in the back. A few moments later, a female elf in her late 20s came from the door behind the desk. She had dark green hair styled in a no-nonsense ponytail with eyes to match, and her slender, elegant figure was wrapped in an expensive-looking white and gold garment that looked more like an evening gown than a robe.
"Hi there,"
she greeted Boxy and the clerk.
"What's up, Holt? Who's your friend?"
"Hey, Aelia! This is Chester,"
Holt replied.
"Lad here needed some magic items appraised."
"I see. Follow me, please."
"Shouldn't I pay first?"
Boxy asked. Aelia shook her head.
"We'll charge you for everything once we're done."
"Oh, all right."
The elf woman led Boxy through the same door she had exited just moments ago, guiding it through a series of corridors before they arrived at her office. It was much bigger than Grimebeard's, presumably because it also doubled as a workshop of sorts. Various ingredients, materials, and weapons were organized neatly atop a stone counter that almost resembled an altar, a notion reinforced by the glowing sigils and runes etched into it.
"That's just my enchanting station,"
the woman explained when she noticed her guest staring.
"Forgive the mess. I was just taking a break from a bulk order."
She sat down on the plush couch in the room's open area and invited Chester to sit in the armchair opposite her. Boxy obliged, though it had to remove its staff from the sling over its shoulder in order to do so.
"I see you're a magic user,"
she said with a businesslike smile.
"Let me guess. Warlock?"
"Yes,"
the shapeshifter admitted, mildly surprised.
"How'd you know?"
"Your type likes to wear red or purple robes like yours, I've noticed. Now, enough small talk. What would you like appraised?"
"This."
Boxy raised the staff in its arms, much to the surprise of the woman sitting opposite it.
"I got it recently from a dungeon," it added. "I need to know what it does."
"I understand. Then, if you'll allow me."
She held her hands out as if asking to be passed the staff. Boxy hesitated a bit, but this place seemed a lot more reputable than the order, so it reluctantly handed it over. only to have the metal staff slip from her fingers and go crashing to the floor.
Oh, darn it! I'm so sorry,
she apologized immediately.
I didn't think it would be so heavy after seeing you handle it so easily.
The casual comment sent Boxy's internal thoughts into panic mode. Of course, a feeble magic user shouldn't be able to carry this thing. Even Snack couldn't lift it, and she was a demon. Granted, all other things being equal, succubi were physically weaker than adult humans, but that didn't change the fact that Boxy had messed up.
Guess you must be stronger than you look under those robes.
Struck by a moment of inspiration at Alia's comment, the doppelganger subtly shifted the flesh underneath its baggy clothing.
Yes, it nodded. Want to see?
There's no need to... Oh, my!
The elf had barely spoken before Boxy opened its robes to reveal a set of rippling abs and bulging pecs. It was the kind of well-developed, nearly fiend-like musculature that would have benefited greatly from even the tiniest bit of strength. Certainly not the sort of body one would expect to see on a stereotypical 17-year-old elven spellslinger, but Alia didn't seem bothered at all. Quite the opposite, actually.
Can I touch them?
Chester nodded, and she leaned forward, extending her arm hesitantly. She placed her slender fingers on its ripped body, slowly trailing them up and down the delightfully firm muscles. She found herself attracted to the masculine display not just because that was the sort of thing she was into. That was a big part of it, but it was also the fact that this beefcake's 3-digit charisma score was specifically designed to reel her in even deeper.
I apologize.
She pulled her hand back suddenly.
I don't know what came over me.
It's no problem.
Then could you, put those away now?
Boxy donned its clothes once more, satisfied that its brilliant ruse had worked. Alia, on the other hand, coughed into her clenched fist in an attempt to dispel what she perceived as an awkward atmosphere.
In any event, could I ask you to hold that up for me?
The shapeshifter did as she requested, allowing her to appraise the item without having to bear its weight. Much like the dwarf before her, her reaction was rather extraordinary.
My word!
She exclaimed in awe.
You have yourself an artifact there!
What now?
You don't know what an artifact is.
I had an unpleasant encounter with a demon recently and forgot some things.
Boxy had internally classified this response as ignorance excuse B.
Oh, I see. No worries. I'll explain everything. Let me just get a form.
A short trip to her desk and a quick bout of scribbling later, she returned to her seat on the couch. She patted the cushion next to her, inviting Chester to get a better look at the piece of paper in her hands, an offer it readily accepted. Name, Voidcaller. Maker, Sthulmir Grarabrarm. Type, Staff. Quality, Artifact. Offense, C. Defense, E+. Durability, AA+. Magic Amplification, 10% all, 20% dark. Enchantments. Greater channeling. Greater intelligence. Lesser magic resistance. Reduced weight. Innate ability. Estimated value? Priceless. Notes. An adamantite greatstaff containing the essence of a powerful demon, likely its creator. Strong connection to the beyond. Only those who have embraced such eldritch energies are capable of truly harnessing its potential. Heavier than other weapons of its type, requiring a good deal of physical strength to wield properly. Unfortunately, it hadn't learned to read in the past half hour, so none of that made any sense to it. It could, however, recognize the shapes well enough to tell that a lot of the letter and number combinations were the same as the ones that that Grimebeard fellow had given it. Barring the difference in handwriting, of course. That meant that the dwarf had actually been truthful. But that did little to help Boxy comprehend the information it had been given.
Can you explain everything from the top? Just in case?
Of course,
Alia agreed.
So, the name of the item and its maker at the top are pretty straightforward. I have to say, though, this is the first time I've ever seen a name like this. I'm not sure I can even pronounce it.
Must be a demon's name, Boxy remarked. How did you know who made it, though?
Most magic items are imprinted with metamagical data. Think of it as a label that any scribe can read, but nobody else can see.
Ah, handy. What's next?
She continued, pointing out the words as she moved down the page.
That's the item's type, its official classification. It tells you what skills and masteries best work with it, this one clearly being a staff.
Isn't that kinda obvious? I mean, I got staff mastery when I hit stuff with it.
Which, in turn, had given the pretend elf a small but not unwelcome boost of strength and endurance.
Sometimes it can be hard to tell right away.
Aelia shrugged.
It doesn't hurt to spell it out anyway. So we put it on all our appraisal result forms.
Makes sense.
Up next, we have the item's quality rating. In this case, a staggeringly powerful artifact-grade item.
Oh, you mean like superior?
She hummed lightly.
Yes and no. This one is much higher. Want me to go over them all?
I would appreciate it.
The shapeshifter nodded. The elf touched briefly upon the 9 tiers on which items were graded based on performance. At the bottom were unusable and poor quality, which were mostly trash, followed by good, fine, and superior. Boxy was aware of these tiers, as it had hit all of them when creating items with its artificer job. Superior was also the highest quality items that most common adventurers could hope to get their hands on. Masterwork class items were one step above superior, and were usually created through the cooperation of multiple skilled craftsmen. For instance, a master blacksmith might make a brilliant war axe graded superior, then find an enchanter to imbue it with magical properties in order to upgrade it to a masterwork. There were also extremely talented individuals out there who could create a masterwork entirely by themselves, but this required true mastery of one's craft and only the absolute finest raw materials. It was also the highest ceiling that the vast majority of artisans could hope to hit, as it took exceptionally special circumstances to create artifact-ranked gear. These were truly unique items that could never be replicated, let alone mass-produced, so it was safe to say that Boxy's staff, which Aelia helpfully revealed was called Void Caller, was the only one of its kind. Yet, extraordinary as that was, there were 2 tiers above even that, namely Phantasmal and Divine, each class significantly rarer and more powerful than its predecessor. If the artifacts in circulation around the world numbered only a few hundred, then there were only 20 or 30 Phantasmal items. Boxy really wanted to get its tentacles on one of those, but it would appear that their owners were insanely powerful individuals far above its current power level. The ultimate in equipment, divine items, were unfortunately nothing but a pipe dream. They were shrouded in myths and legends, said to have been forged by the gods themselves. It was speculated there were only 9 in existence, 1 for each member of Terrania's pantheon, but history suggested that even that was a generous estimate. According to Aelia, only 3 of the 9 mythical items had been recorded in the Lodrak Empire's 6.5 centuries of history.
And 2 of them were so powerful that they sparked armed conflicts with other nations, she concluded. Then again, this is the empire we're talking about, so those wars could have been fought over anything.
Very interesting, Boxy commented. You sure know a lot about stuff.
Well, I am a scribe, after all.
The elf smiled, tucking her green hair behind a pointy ear.
I wouldn't be able to accurately evaluate items if I didn't know a fair bit of everything.
Indeed, if the scribe doing the appraisals wasn't knowledgeable in a great number of fields, then the result of their analysis would be inconclusive at best, outright misleading at worst. That was why Boxy couldn't have just asked that guy at the gate to inspect its gear.
So, what's next on the list?
Chester inquired.
Right. Next, we have the offensive, defensive, and durability ratings. How much damage the item can deal, prevent, or withstand, respectively. Voidcaller's offense is at C, meaning that it's about as damaging as an unenchanted steel warhammer, and defensively it's at E+, which is pretty terrible. Not surprising, since you can't block much with it, and it has nothing to defuse the impact of a blow.
So, it's a terrible weapon?
Relatively, yes. But still better than the double Fs most staves receive in that category. Oh, And I should mention that the offensive rating is purely in terms of physical damage. The staff's ability to boost magic is not factored into it.
All right. And what does the durability rating mean?
Double A plus means that it's practically indestructible. Like, a dragon could probably step on this thing and it would barely make a dent. I mean, it's made of adamantite.
Now, there was a word Boxy was familiar with. To its knowledge, adamantite was considered the ultimate metal in both hardiness and weight. It had assumed that the material would be shinier, though. Not this thoroughly unappetizing pitch black.
Next, we have magic amplification,
the elf continued.
10% to all spells and 20% to darkness-based spells is extremely good, by the way. You don't see these kinds of numbers on anything below artifact. At least, not at the same time.
Is it just spells? Does it amplify skill damage too?
Yes, assuming that they directly deal elemental damage,
she nodded. This was good to know, as damaging skills didn't scale with intelligence in the same way that spells did. That meant that they would likely only fall behind its other means of killing as Boxy's level continued to climb. Admittedly, at present that applied only to acid spray, but it was nonetheless good information to have when considering future skill choices.
Next, you have your passive enchantments,
Aelia stated, beginning to list them off.
Greater channeling cuts 10% off your spell costs. Greater intelligence is a passive boost of 50 intelligence points. Lesser magic resistance reduces all magic damage taken by 5%. Reduced weight makes the item 3 times lighter, which is kind of necessary for adamantite gear. I doubt even your powerful arms could lift this thing without that.
Feeling a bit daring, she decided to test the waters by throwing an arm around Chester's shoulder. Boxy was at first rather confused by her action, but it quickly remembered one of Snack's lessons. Handshakes, salutes, waves, and other hand-based gestures were meant to be reciprocated, firmly whenever possible. As such, it returned the gesture and held Aelia tightly, causing her to blush.
The innate ability,
she tried to continue.
It's like an item-based skill, something unique to artifacts and higher, but not all have one.
Oh? What's mine do?
I'm not sure, but you can find out by activating it.
How do I do that?
Typically, you grab the item and start channeling your mana into it until it's fully charged, at which point it should activate and... What are you doing?
Before Aelia could stop it, Boxy had stood from the couch, gripping Void Caller with both hands. Fizzy had already taught it how to channel its mana when she had showed it how to use a mana-fueled welding torch, but it hadn't even considered trying to use it with the unshiny thing. And now that it tried, it discovered that the staff was thirsty.
Could you not do anything unnecessary?
Boxy ignored her complaints and channeled precisely 666 MP into the weapon. The ornamental skull's jawbone rattled as though it were trying to come alive, its 4 jeweled eye sockets glowing intensely. At first, nothing seemed to happen, but it was suddenly struck by the strangest urge to summon something. Deciding to see the experiment through, it dismissed Snack, then activated Summon Familiar to bring her back. But what transpired next differed vastly from the usual spinning concentric circles of light. Instead, a number of things happened at almost exactly the same time, starting with the appearance of an oval-shaped portal of bright red energy directly in front of Boxy. A gust of wind followed, strong enough to scatter most of Aelia's paperwork and belongings around her office workshop. A blue-skinned succubus fell through the person-sized interdimensional doorway, landing in confused disorientation on the nearby coffee table. The arcane energy and erratic air currents faded a few moments later, less than a second after the whole thing had begun.
What the fuck are you doing?
Aelia finally managed to shriek.
Testing?
The not-an-elf replied dumbly.
You don't just do that in someone's workplace,
she continued shouting.
Especially not-
Master?
Zira grumbled, rising to her feet.
Is that a succubus? Really?
She's my familiar. She burns things real good.
I don't care. I want you to sleep.
Zira did what she did best and pacified the situation through underhanded means. putting the woman under her spell. Aelia collapsed on the couch, and Zira busily began altering her short-term memories with her Dreamweaver skill. She didn't even have to ask what was going on, as she knew her master well enough to understand the gist of it.
"Snack, tell me what this says."
Boxy shoved the appraisal report in front of her face, and she read the whole thing out for it as she continued to mess with the elf woman's brain. She was a skilled multitasker, though, so she was able to give it the information it wanted without any issue. Once everything was settled, she was sent back to the Beyond so that her box-brained master could resume its meeting a few seconds prior to everything going to shit. Business as usual, in other words.
Could you not do anything unnecessary?
The elf repeated herself after abruptly waking up.
I apologize. I got a bit excited.
Boxy bowed its head, then sat back down.
It's not as though I don't understand, but please keep your surroundings in mind.
Of course. I'll test this later in a safer space.
And when it did, it would realize that Voidcaller had the ability to summon either of its familiars instantly, and at only a fraction of the MP cost. And despite spending significantly less MP on conjuring their bodies, both Snack and Arms would still arrive at full strength with no apparent negative side effects, other than a brief moment of disorientation. It was an ability best used in emergency situations, in which one or both of its familiars died in combat. However, it would have to be used sparingly, as Voidcaller's summoning empowerment could only be activated once every 2 hours. Once it had finished testing the artifact's limits, Boxy would finally start to question how, exactly, it had come into possession of the staff. It was so perfect for the shapeshifter's peculiar take on the warlock job that it almost felt as though it had been custom-made just for it. If this had happened earlier, it would have attributed its acquisition to good fortune, and that would have been the end of it. However, it was currently beholden to a goddess of chance, so it couldn't help but ponder the possibility of interference on her part. Indeed, it would be impossible not to at least suspect Willie's involvement in the matter, considering that it was his recruitment that had set the whole thing into motion. Then again, as the god himself had said, a prediction was not the same as a prophecy. There existed in all things an element of randomness and uncertainty, and no outcome was truly 100% certain. He had also mentioned that he despised having to interfere directly, since that would make things boring, and the entertainment value had been her only reason for making Boxy her hero in the first place. Therefore, it was also plausible that the ganger acquiring the first of hopefully many artifacts was nothing more than blind luck. The fact was, it was ultimately pointless to question whether something had happened by pure chance or due to some divine plan devised by Boxy's patron deity. And honestly, the two things were completely indistinguishable whenever Ernesto was involved anyway. It was impossible to come to a definite conclusion one way or the other, and Boxy would eventually just accept the magic stick and move on with its life. Such mental gymnastics were for the future, however. Right now, the shapeshifter had a far more pressing question.
So, the estimated value says priceless. Does that mean that I can sell it for infinite money?
Ha! Ha ha ha! Ah, that was a good one.
The elf forced a laugh.
No, silly. It just means that you literally can't put a price on something like this. You'd have to auction it off if you ever wanted to sell it, but I wouldn't if I were you. Even if you receive enough money to set yourself up for life, you'd never get another like it.
Boxy wasn't entirely sure what to think about that.
Can you appraise another item for me?
Of course, Chester. I'd be delighted to.
Hold on. Let me go get it.
It left the office in a bit of a hurry, leaving Aelia alone with her thoughts. Now that she was no longer distracted by the strangely hunky youngster, she couldn't help but notice that things seemed a little off. Although Snack and Boxy had done their best to put everything back to where it had been while she'd been asleep, they had failed to do a very good job of it. Thankfully, the false elf returned before the scribe could put two and two together, dragging a ridiculous-looking thing along by the shoulder.
"Hi, I'm back,"
it said casually.
"I can see that. And what, have you got there?"
"This is Fizzy. She's my golem. She talks."
"Hi.
the steel paladin said dully, giving the woman a lazy wave.
Oh, that's the one everyone's been losing their marbles over, hmm?
Aelia stood to take a closer look.
She does look extremely lifelike. Wait, is this the item you wanted appraised?
No, just the shield,
Boxy clarified.
Look, can we get this over with?
Fizzy demanded.
Those idiots down there don't know a bidirectional spark plug from a hopper back connector circuit, and I do not trust them to handle that order by themselves.
Sure, I'll be just a moment. Care to show me the... Okay, that's a cursed item, isn't it?
She had barely even had to look at the article to guess what was wrong with it.
It is. That's why I'm having the gnome use it. Golem!
Boxy quickly corrected itself.
I meant golem, not gnome.
Whatever. Just... let me see it.
Aelia seemed unwilling to touch the profane object for even the few seconds necessary to complete the evaluation, but she forced herself to do it. Once the examination was complete, she headed to the sink next to her enchanter's station to scrub her hands thoroughly while Fizzy returned to the smithy. The elf took another appraisal form and filled it out before presenting it to Boxy. Name? Left Hand of the Forsaken Sentinel. Maker? Unknown. Type? Plate Armor. Quality? Artifact. Offense? D. Defense? B+. Durability? A. Magic Amplification? None. Enchantments. Enhanced Durability. Self-Repair. Well-Fitted. Lesser Lightning Resistance. Curse of the Steel Shaper. Estimated Value? Priceless. Notes. An ancient gauntlet from an age long past, forged from mithril-enriched steel alloy and fortified with magic. Supremely well-crafted, has survived the passage of time as well as numerous battles with no permanent damage. A terrible power dwells within, for it still bears the grudge of its former wielder. The creature was only slightly less clueless this time around, as it already knew what each field said, as well as the shape of at least some of the words. It was able to recognize that there was no innate ability to the gauntlet, which was unfortunate, though it was still priceless, at the very least. As far as the enchantments went, Aelia was kind enough to explain each of them, as she had done with the staff.
Enhanced durability and self-repair do exactly what they say. They're a common combination for armor pieces since they improve their effectiveness, longevity, and reduce maintenance. Well-fitted allows it to adjust its size to fit the wearer. Within reason, of course. Lesser lightning resistance is also self-explanatory, but this curse of the steel shaper... I've never seen anything like it before. Do you know anything about it?
Not really, Chester shrugged. Just that it's what makes Fizzy so... lifelike.
Hmm, I see. You may want to have her control rod examined, just in case. Wouldn't want a rogue golem stabbing you in the back.
Noted.
Will that be everything, then?
The elf asked with a coy smile.
Actually, there is one more item I'd like you to take a look at. Two, actually.
Boxy pretended to reach under its cloak and stealthily retrieved its trusty mithril daggers from its storage. Aelia was both disappointed and relieved that her bizarre client had produced a reasonable item for once. The appraisal results showed no surprises either.
Name, Mithril Dirk, SN22-15. Maker, Hurak Halfbelt. Type, Dagger. Quality, Superior. Offense, B. Defense, D+. Durability, A. Magic Amplification, 3% all. Enchantments, none. Estimated Value, 550 GP. Notes. A long, thrusting dagger forged from pure mithril by the dwarven smiths of Einharvel. It boasts superior sharpness and durability.
As you can see,
the elf stated, scooting closer to Chester,
it's a very basic but reliable weapon. The other one's pretty much identical, so I didn't bother writing both of them up.
What about these numbers up here?
Boxy pointed to the page.
Oh, that's just a serial number. Mass-produced weapons don't get fancy names like Void Caller or Left Hand of the Forsaken Sentinel, just an identifier that can be tracked in case it was stolen or used to commit crimes.
That would hardly be a concern for Boxy, since the dagger's previous owner wasn't in any position to report them stolen. That said, there was no telling what might happen if their original wielder did come looking for them, so it was probably best that the former mimic not flaunt them over much in public.
You know, I could enchant those for you,
Aelia offered.
I'm quite good at it, if I do say so myself.
That certainly sounded enticing. But there was one problem. An enchantment could not be removed once bound to an item, and the process carried the risk of breaking the item completely if too much mana were poured into it. That was why durable or magic-conductive materials like adamantite or mithril were necessary for top-tier enchanted equipment. Regardless, Boxy was wary of letting this random stranger do unpredictable things to its shiny knives, so it politely declined.
No.
Or at least, as polite as a 4-month-old monster could be under the circumstances.
A pity,
the elf said lazily, brushing her hair back.
Then is there anything else I can do for you? Some special service?
I already said I don't want enchantments.
What about something more physical?
Boxy was honestly baffled.
What? Like training?
You could call it that. I certainly have a lot to teach a young stud like you,
she cooed while stroking Chester's inner thigh.
Things only an experienced woman would know.
Did she mean spells? Was she offering to teach it magic? Or maybe some kind of little-known trick?
Could you be more specific?
Aelia smiled and leaned into the false elf's ear, whispering a number of naughty things that finally helped the dense creature to realize what she was getting at. It naturally had no intention of taking part in any promiscuous activities, nor had it been consciously broadcasting any such inclinations, so it had no idea how things had come to this. Now that the situation had arisen, however, its cunning wit spied an opportunity. If succubi like Snack could use lust as a tool, then what was stopping it from doing the same? Chester had something Aelia wanted, which meant that this was an opportunity to secure some profit.
What's in it for me?
It asked bluntly. After all, give and take was one of the fundamental building blocks of society.
Oh, a shrewd one, are you? Tell you what, you help me scratch my itch and take my mind off my troubles, and I'll waive your appraisal fees.
Was that a good deal? Come to think of it, Boxy had neglected to inquire as to price in the first place. If it was 25 GP as per the orders branch, then the total would come to an even 100. However, it was likely that this establishment charged more, considering that everything in the place looked markedly expensive. Even then, this probably wouldn't be worth its time unless it took Aelia's offer of tutelage seriously instead of interpreting it as her being coy.
All right, let's do it.
Which was precisely the sort of misunderstanding that had taken place. Once the deed was done, Chester Underwood returned to the lobby to find Fizzy waiting for it. The steel golem was sitting cross-legged on the floor next to a sealed wooden crate big enough to fit at least 3 of her. Her statuesque stillness ended abruptly when she noticed Boxy's approach, prompting her to stand and throw her arms into the air in exasperation.
Finally!
She exclaimed.
What took you so long?
The golem's attitude was entirely justified, as she had been told that they were in a hurry and had rushed things as a result. If she had known that she'd have some extra time on her hands, she would have put it into making sure her work order was completed to a slightly higher standard.
I was learning about stuff, the elf replied curtly.
Oh, well, at least it was productive.
Truth be told, Boxy would probably still be going if Aelia hadn't passed out from exhaustion. She'd kept screaming, "More, do me more," so often that her voice had started to go hoarse. It was a miracle that nobody had come to check on her with all that yelling, but the elf had likely soundproofed her office. Still, as promised, Boxy had indeed learned something from the encounter. The elf had taught it a number of interesting techniques that would no doubt come in useful if something like this were to happen again. It would just need to keep in mind that, looking back, 2 hours of non-stop pounding was probably overdoing it.
Whatever. Can we please get a move on? It's already evening.
Sure.
Can you help me carry this, though? It's not all that heavy, but it's awfully unwieldy.
The golem grabbed the crate by one end, and Boxy took the other as the two of them proceeded to head out of the Union Building and into the street.
"By the way, did you find out if you can get your paladin job advanced?"
the shapeshifter asked matter-of-factly. That was one of the things that the golem had been supposed to accomplish, along with procuring its artificer supplies. She had been given a bag of gold to that end and told to not cause any trouble with the trainers, then to wait at the boot-split craftsman's union until Boxy returned.
"I did better than that,"
Fizzy exclaimed.
"I'm now a level 28 paladin."
"Wait, you got past the full appraisal already?"
"Yep."
"How?"
There were more than a few out-of-place things on her status, so Boxy had been certain that she would be denied outright. It had at least been unlikely that anyone would have attacked her, since these people seemed far more accepting of a talking golem than it had honestly anticipated, which was the only reason that it had allowed her to roam around by herself in the first place.
"I told the paladin trainer how my life was saved by the obscure god of probability, which is why I champion his name in return,"
she explained.
"I also fed him and his mates a line about how bearing this horrible curse is penance for my past sins, or whatever."
"And that worked?"
"Oh, yeah. They ate that shit up. I just listened to Snack's advice about how those righteous types were suckers for self-sacrifice and repaying debts, and it was spot on. Oh, right. Here's the leftover money you gave me. Thanks ever so much."
Fizzy pulled a coin pouch from her trousers and handed it to Boxy with a wide smile.
"There's more gold left over than I would have thought," it noted.
"Yeah, I got a good price for the part since I'm technically still a member of Erosa's Craftsman's Union. They even offered me a position as Artificer Instructor, but I had to turn them down."
"I see. What about the paladin training fee?"
"Well, that did cost quite a bit, but the people over there were super impressed by my sob story and glorious steel frame, so I got it discounted from 230 to 200 GP.
"Gah!"
Boxy nearly spat with rage. What was with this unfair treatment? Why was paladin training less than half the price of warlock training? Such blatant favoritism and discrimination surely had to be against the rules. But, on the other hand, that did mean that Boxy hadn't had to shell out a whole 1,000 GP for training. The cost reduction on both the job advancement and the artificer components was definitely a good thing, especially since it had accepted those only begrudgingly as necessary expenses for getting stronger. Honestly, if gold coins hadn't been so wonderfully shiny, it wouldn't have batted an eye at spending so many, though most of the time it didn't have much choice. One typically had to use the power of money if they wanted to obtain something in civilized society, and money just happened to be shiny. And, speaking of society, the immediate populace was currently taking a healthy amount of interest in the newcomer and its pet golem. There was a plethora of people staring at the odd duo as they walked down the street, which was the exact opposite of blending in. The massive crate rattling with their every step wasn't exactly helping matters, so they ducked inside a small, quiet alley, away from prying eyes. After making sure that nobody was peeping or eavesdropping, Boxy quickly stuffed the parts inside the crate into its storage. It also took the opportunity to resummon Zira, though the succubus seemed strangely displeased about something. Neither the golem nor the ganger cared enough to ask her about it, however. She was told instead to suck it up and conceal her demonic identity, which she did by assuming the guise of a nondescript elven adventurer eerily similar to Aelia. Boxy wanted her available should a fight break out, and while warlocks walking around with their familiars may not have been illegal, it was still heavily frowned upon. Not to mention that it wasn't particularly subtle. The ex-mimic had decided that it would leave town ahead of schedule. After all, it had already accomplished everything it had wanted to do here, and lingering was pointless. Dangerous, even. Fizzy's full appraisal would have left a record of her name, serving as undeniable proof that she had passed through the town. Even if appraisal results were supposed to be strictly confidential, someone with an important-sounding title like Spy Master was sure to get a hold of them eventually. But it appeared that plans to leave would have to be slightly delayed. First, it would have to deal with the strangers blocking the alley's exit. There were 5 male dwarves, all clad in matching light armor with strange tattoos around their eyes and on their cheeks, not to mention that they were quite well-armed. The 2 identical fellows on the left held compact crossbows that were already loaded, and the one on the far right was unhooking a pair of axes from his hip. Meanwhile, his friend immediately next to him was licking the blade of his dagger, which he probably thought looked intimidating, but the only thing the gesture did was make Boxy wonder if the steel knife was tasty. The dwarf in the middle, the one carrying a large, two-handed axe on his shoulder, likely the leader of this little posse, took a few steps forward.
"Pardon me a moment, sir," he called with mock politeness, "but would you be willing to donate to the Boot Split charity drive for starving orphans?"
The false elf stared dumbly at the odd little man, unable to comprehend what he was talking about.
"I don't follow,"
it eventually responded. The thug-in-chief flashed an evil grin, showing a few gilded teeth.
"It's no big deal. We're just going to relieve you of your excess baggage in order to help those in need. Namely, myself and me compatriots."
The other four chuckled grimly, but their leader's roundabout way of speaking had only served to confuse Boxy further.
"Excuse me, Master?"
Zira spoke through the telepathic link.
"But I do believe that these people are trying to take your shinies."
"You're trying to rob me?"
Boxy asked the would-be thieves incredulously.
"That's such a nasty way of putting it,"
the leader shook his head.
"Mandatory donations sound so much better, in my opinion."
"Oh, how nice,"
exclaimed Boxy, to the surprise of everyone present.
"Really?"
Fizzy couldn't help but ask.
"How is any of this nice?"
"I've never been mugged before,"
was the cheerful reply.
"I always wondered what it would be like."
The thug's attitude turned sour when he saw his Mark's carefree attitude. The information he had been given had said that the guy was a clueless warlock with more money than brains, so he'd wanted to toy with the boy a little. However, he had underestimated just how idiotic the elf truly was. The whelp clearly had no idea how deep the shit he was currently in truly ran.
"You two," he murmured to the dwarves on his right. "Fire a couple warning shots into his face."
The crossbow-wielding twins didn't hesitate, firing a bolt each at the smiling elf's head. One of them hit the guy in the eye while the other pierced his forehead, striking with enough force to knock the young man over backwards. The thug-in-chief scoffed at how easy it had been. Now all they had to do was get rid of its incognito familiar and the metal golem, and they'd be practically rolling in it.
"Weak!"
What should have been a corpse suddenly spoke, putting the five criminals on high alert.
"Level 25, 30 at most. Way too weak. Only good as a light snack."
The ginger elf stood slowly, his words ominously monotone. The wooden bolts fell from its skull one after the other as the should-have-been-fatal wounds closed in a matter of moments. The thugs felt chills down their spines when they recognized the clearly unnatural creature before them. Nothing in the briefing had said anything about this.
"That's okay,"
the not-an-elf reassured them, its face twisted into a sweet, terrifyingly calm smile.
"You're just in time for dinner."
The thieves' nervousness turned to fear, and then panic, as they watched what should have been an easy mark transform into a whirlwind of steel, teeth, and flesh, which descended upon them like death incarnate. Suffice to say, the town of Bootsplit was about to experience a dramatic spike in murders, followed by a period of unnaturally low crime. Part 6. A dwarf napped pleasantly in his simple wooden chair, his soft snores echoing slightly through the narrow stone hallway he was supposed to be keeping an eye on. Although this behavior was certainly not befitting an official guard, none of his peers would be able to fault him for it. The actual guarding consisted solely of waiting for someone on the other side of the circular steel door next to him to speak the password so that he could open it from the inside. He was more akin to a doorman than an actual guard. After all, the door in question was not only cleverly concealed as one of the many wine casks inside a large restaurant cellar, but it was also impossible to open from the outside. Granted, this wasn't the only way in or out of the hidden complex, but it was the most commonly used passage of the grunts and enforcers of the Honeydew Cartel. They had a separate entrance at the opposite end that was mostly used for ferrying goods in and out of the hideout, but they only used that for huge shipments that wouldn't have fit otherwise. Just because their organization wasn't particularly big didn't mean that they shouldn't take a few extra precautions, so as not to be discovered. Especially considering that their main source of income wasn't extortion or armed robbery. That was for brainless bandits who lived in the woods and slept in the dirt. Admittedly, the cartel would still do these things on the side when a good opportunity presented itself, but their specialty was smuggling. The town's proximity to the northern border and the Imperial Highway meant that all manner of cargo, illegal or otherwise, had to pass through Boot Split in one way or another. As such, it was inevitable that smuggling rings would take root in the settlement. The Honeydew Cartel in particular worked mainly with narcotic substances of a highly addictive nature, such as fairy dust or the honeydew they had named themselves for. The drugs were produced en masse in the Ishigar Republic to the north, where their use and sale wasn't illegal like it was in the Empire, though it was still strictly regulated. They were smuggled across the border and resold to other organizations looking to peddle them to any commoners looking for a fix. Overall, the setup ensured a steady stream of profit for everyone involved. Except, of course, the users. As a secondary source of income, the cartel also dabbled in arms trafficking, which involved selling fine and superior Empire-forged weapons and armor to the elves across the border. This wasn't strictly illegal, but skirting the strict regulations and heavy taxation involved meant that the payoff was worth the minimal risk. All things said and done, the organization was doing quite well for itself, although its members didn't even number in the triple digits. Unfortunately, they were rather lacking in the information department. Most traders and merchants simply passed through Boot Split without lingering, at most stopping only to rest for the night before moving on towards the capital. One could hardly blame them, considering the shady elements that dwelled here, but it made gathering sensitive intel quite the challenge. That didn't mean that they didn't try, however. The cartel had an informant in pretty much every guild in town, offering them a bounty of gold for any juicy information from the Empire's heartland. One such mole was a warlock going by the rather unsavory name of Grimebeard. In fact, he had alerted them earlier today of a young and relatively low-leveled elf with an artifact-grade item in his possession. It had been clear that he'd wanted the item for himself, but the cartel had had other ideas. A single one of those ancient treasures could fetch tens of thousands of GP if sold to the right bidder, far more than anything the old warlock could possibly offer them. He had been told in no uncertain terms that the cartel would be taking charge of the artifact to sell to their contacts across the border. The old dwarf had momentarily forgotten that, no matter how amicable they seemed, the Honeydew Cartel was still a criminal gang that would always put their own profits first. He had had to begrudgingly give up on getting his hands on the staff, though he'd been somewhat placated by the extra-large finder's fee. It wasn't exactly what he had wanted, but it would still be quite a bit more than the big fat nothing he would have gotten otherwise. After agreeing to the cartel's terms, he told them everything he knew about the Mark, a young man by the name of Chester Underwood. Everything from his appearance right down to the confidential information Grimebeard had gleaned from his full appraisal. The cartel had quickly realized that this was the same ginger-haired elf with the personal steel golem whom one of their own had identified as a potential person of interest earlier that day. The chance to get their hands not only on the artifact, but also the golem's control rod had simply been too good to pass up. So, the boss had decided that they would just gobble up the unsuspecting elf. It would hardly be the first time they had made someone disappear, and the job would be easy enough as long as they could take him out quickly and quietly. Six of their enforcers had immediately been dispatched to track down Mr. Underwood and relieve him of both his valuables and his life. Although a few of them had thought that sending so many was perhaps overkill, none of them particularly minded ganging up on a single kid if it meant that they'd get paid without losing any of their fellows. That had been over 5 hours ago.
Frozen pickles!
The slumbering doorman was rudely woken by an aggressive knock at the door. After taking a few seconds to wake up and a few more wondering what he had just said, he finally realized that he had a visitor.
15!
A panicked voice called from outside.
22! 64! 30! Yeah, 30!
The dwarf rubbed the sleep from his eyes, double-checking the note on the wall to confirm that the numbers were indeed that week's password. He stood from his chair and walked to the circular metal door next to his station, kicking it once to show that he had heard. He placed a hand on the valve-like locking mechanism and was about to turn it when the voice on the other side started yelling again.
Hurry it up!
Hold your horses, arsehole!
He shouted back. Everyone knew that the door was too heavy to just magically swing open all on its own. Not that that wasn't possible, it was just far cheaper to have a low-ranking grunt do the heavy lifting. The large valve turned two full revolutions before the heavy locks finally disengaged. The guard pulled the door ajar with a bit of effort, allowing a draft of fresh air to rush in as the main entrance opened slowly. The gatekeeper peered through the doorway to see a thin, tattooed dwarf, his gear drenched in sweat, standing in the middle of the cellar. He lunged through the opening, shoving the guard roughly out of the way, then hurriedly shoved the door closed and spun the lock. Once the entrance had been firmly sealed, he slid to the ground with his back against the door, panting heavily from both exertion and fear.
"Tobbs, what the blast are you doing?"
the shocked doorman asked.
"Wait, where are the others?"
The ironically nicknamed Tubbs had been one of the six that had left earlier that day. The fact that he was returning alone and in such a dire state was distressing, to say the least.
"They're dead!"
he blurted between gasps for air.
"Dead? What do you mean, dead? I thought you guys were just going to nab some scrawny twig."
That had supposedly been a sure thing. So how had...
"That was no fucking elf!"
Tubbs screamed, his body and voice quivering.
"I don't know what that thing was, but it was nothing like we were told."
"Then the others?"
"It ate them, man! It fucking gobbled them up like it was nothing! There was nothing I could do. It would have gotten me too if I hadn't run."
"Teresa's tits. Did that guy follow you here?"
I don't know. I don't think so. But we can't take any chances. If that bastard Grimebeard set us up, then he might have sold out our hideout as well. We gotta warn the boss."
"Fuck, you're right. Wait, why we?"
I need your help. I can barely walk."
The gatekeeper examined the sweat-drenched Tubbs. He looked half-dead. The slender dwarf must have run clear across town at full speed for him to be this worn out. Plus, it was readily apparent that not all of the sweat was due to physical exertion. Clearly, this was an emergency, so his bosses would hardly berate him for abandoning his post. Manning the front door at the moment would be pointless anyway, as Tubbs' group had been the only ones scheduled to return tonight. Informing the boss what had happened to her boys, on the other hand, was of paramount importance. While she was ruthless to outsiders, she took good care of the boys under her wing, which had fostered an odd sense of camaraderie one wouldn't have expected from a gang of criminals. The Honeydew cartel treated one another like family, and none of the men would be satisfied unless this treachery was dealt with swiftly and decisively.
"All right, take my shoulder,"
the doorman said, propping up the exhausted rogue. They moved hurriedly down the hallway, making their way out of the passage and into a cavern dug into the side of a hill near the edge of the town. The dome-shaped structure had been created by magic and served as the hub of the Honeydew cartel's operations. The main chamber was a shared living space dotted with tables and chairs, a large kitchen on one side. The center was dominated by a small arena where organized fistfights and other entertainment often took place. A number of doors lined the walls, each leading to a small room used for either storage or sleeping areas. Tubbs and his escort circled the edge of the chamber towards the wall opposite the one they'd come in, drawing curious and worried glances from the roughly 24 dwarves milling about the area. All had similar facial tattoos, marking them as members of the Honeydew cartel and serving as a warning to people in the area not to dare lay a finger on any of the blokes. "Don't mess with the cartel, and they won't mess with you," was the unspoken rule in this neighborhood. The pair quickly reached a set of heavy wooden doors, beyond which lay the boss's chambers.
"Hey, Tammy, what's up with Tubbs?"
one of the two dwarves guarding the room asked.
"Got bad news, Rocker,"
the doorman panted.
"Tubbs here says Hammerhead's group got wiped out."
"Holy shit. Here, let me help.
The muscular dwarf quickly opened the heavy doors and helped to support Tubbs from the other side. The three of them stepped into a simple, sparsely decorated room. Old wooden furniture, including three armchairs, a large bed, and a pair of bookshelves lined the walls while three lanterns illuminated the windowless space. A tiny, wrinkled woman was sitting idly in a rocking chair off to the side, entertaining herself with the thick book in her hands. She lifted her bespectacled gaze from the tome and stared inquisitively at the trio before her.
"What's the matter, dearie?"
she asked in a soft, worried voice. This was Granny Helga. Everything, from her demeanor to her simple clothes, gave the impression of a kindly old grandmother. A far cry from the cold, calculating criminal that lay beneath the facade.
"Tubbs said his group got wiped out, Gran,"
Jammy reported. The woman's soft expression disappeared instantly, replaced by the stern countenance of a gang boss. The change was so drastic that it was as though she had become a different person in the blink of an eye. She motioned for Rocker to leave and close the door behind him, which he did immediately. She needed to handle the ugly situation undisturbed.
"Tell me what happened, Tubbs."
The dwarf in question had been supposed to serve as the group's lookout, watching over them and keeping an eye out for any witnesses or authorities that might interfere with their work. Should a fight break out, he could drop down from the rooftop to support his teammates, or, if he judged that his colleagues were in a hopeless situation, the unpleasant task of reporting their failure would fall to him. The fact that he had returned alone was therefore quite troubling, to say the least. However, Tubbs didn't answer right away. He stared blankly at his feet, mumbling something too low to make out. If Granny Helga hadn't known better, it would almost have sounded like he was chanting a spell. But that was certainly impossible. Tubbs was a rogue, and a damn good one at that. He was quick on his feet and skilled with his hands, but he definitely did not have a head suited for anything so complicated as magic. Unfortunately for Granny Helga, this wasn't the Tubbs she knew.
"Through darkness!"
At the dwarf's words, the entire room was instantly engulfed in shadow, as if light itself was not permitted to exist within the confined space. There were some surprised gasps, a few muffled yells, and the noise of something wet hitting the ground, followed by silence. When the darkness cleared, the only thing left of the dwarves was two puddles of blood and one chest-shaped doppelganger savoring its meal. Tubbs had been long dead. Boxy had noticed him while the dwarf had been trying to get a good angle to kill what he had thought was a warlock while his five compatriots provided a distraction, an endeavor he had abandoned as soon as Chester had showed its true colors. Once the shapeshifter had cleaned up the dwarves in the alley, it had quickly scaled the walls to restrain the last survivor skulking on the rooftop. Zira had then flexed her dreamweaver skill to probe the unwilling dwarf's recent memory, which was how Boxy had learned of this neat little hideout. The plan from that point forward was simple. Pose as the dwarf, infiltrate the base, meet with the leader, and take her out before she could organize a defense. It had managed to pull off its little masquerade surprisingly well, mostly because the box-brained shapeshifter had played the part of someone overcome with fear. The monster had already had plenty of experience watching people flee from it in terror, so it had been able to replicate a state of screaming panic without much difficulty. This little scenario had been good training so far, but it was far from over. The next step after removing the head was to devour the body. Boxy opened its storage and brought Fizzy out, much to her relief. It was a good thing that the former gnome no longer needed to breathe, otherwise she would definitely have suffocated by now. Still, the dark confines were extremely unsettling, so she preferred not to have to spend any more time in there than strictly necessary. Pulling out Voidcaller, the shapeshifter activated the staff's innate ability, the demonic skull once again laughing silently as an interdimensional doorway appeared and a slightly disgruntled Cora stepped out.
"Ah!"
she grunted, clutching her head.
"Bubble Butt was right! Doing it this way is super weird!"
The forced summoning didn't quite allow a demon's consciousness to fully bond with its hastily created body. Although not dangerous to either their soul or their conjured flesh, it nonetheless left them dizzy and disoriented for a few seconds while the former settled into the latter.
"At least you weren't treated like luggage,"
Fizzy frowned slightly.
"Hey, Gran,"
came a muffled shout from outside the room.
"You all right in there?"
It would appear that Rocker had heard the unfamiliar voices and was about to barge in to see what was the matter.
What's the word, boss?
Cora cracked her knuckles in anticipation.
At least 27 targets, 10 of them armed,
Boxy explained.
Likely more in the other rooms or outside, but this should be their main force. Snack is keeping watch on the exit in case any of them try to break out.
The spider chest stowed Voidcaller back into its storage, exchanging the staff for its favorite mithril daggers.
I need 3 or 4 of them alive. Get rid of the rest,
it commanded.
Gran, I'm coming in,
Rocker yelled. Before he could open the door, however, Cora's armored boot sent the heavy wooden object flying off its hinges, along with the dwarf on the wrong side of it. It smashed into a nearby table, pinning Rocker and another befuddled cartel member under its weight. The loud crash gathered the attention of everyone present, all of whom stared in shock as a gigantic wall of muscle almost twice any of their height stepped through the relatively tiny doorway. Then came a flash of something shiny and the sound of steel scraping against stone as the golem activated her armored charge skill. She closed the gap between herself and the nearest unfortunate meatbag in an instant, slamming into the poor sod with enough force to break multiple bones and send him crashing into a group of his friends.
Alarm! Enemy attack!
Someone shouted, sending all the dwarves into high gear. The ones who weren't armed headed quickly to retrieve their weapons, while the ones that were engaged the strange duo. They wanted to confirm Granny Helga's condition, but most of them had already reached the grim conclusion that she was most likely done for. The monsters had emerged from her private chambers, after all, which meant that the only thing they could do right now was try to avenge her. Arrows, throwing knives, and spells flew at the bigger target, while a trio of dwarves armed with maces, axes, and shields engaged the smaller one. Cora activated her demonic carapace, which covered her skin with tough metal scales. She took the barrage head-on as she charged forward, intent on stomping the dwarves into paste. After a few running steps, she leapt through the air, landing right in the middle of a group of 4 crossbow-wielding thugs who rolled away and scattered in a panic. The fiend's powerful legs easily caught up to them as she kicked at the terrified fighters. Having to fight this way was a bit irksome, but these guys were way too short for her to throw any good punches. Fizzy, on the other hand, was struggling. Her wrench flew at the heads and bodies of her opponents with deadly force, but the experienced combatants were able to either deflect the strikes or evade them completely. It seemed that she simply couldn't measure up to the gang when it came to melee combat proficiency. After all, she hadn't even been in a real fight until about a month ago, and even then she had only fought monsters. The dwarves, though, had had ample experience fighting other enlightened due to the nature of their occupation, so they were managing to fend off her amateur attacks despite being weaker. The pint-sized paladin's champion of chaos skill may have given her glimpses into the future, but it wasn't particularly useful when dealing with reactions rather than actions. However, the other side had their own share of troubles. The golem's thick steel hide and cursed shield was repelling all attacks aimed at her, and while she still suffered minor damage, it wasn't nearly enough for her to be worried about. Plus, if things got bad, she could always heal herself in the middle of combat without worrying about random attacks interrupting her chance. And if it turned into a contest of endurance, her near-tireless body would win without question. Not that the scuffle would ever get the chance to reach that stage, though. Boxy had, while doing its best spider chest impression, quietly and stealthily skittered out of the boss's room while the dwarves were preoccupied with its minions. It crawled along the chamber's dome-shaped ceiling, looking for the perfect chance to strike. Once it was in position, it dropped a mirror image of itself onto the dwarves giving Fizzy trouble. Its copy landed directly behind them, using its downward momentum to pierce their scalps with a trio of iron sickles it had forged from its own flesh. It proceeded to follow its initial orders, providing backup for the inexperienced golem as she charged towards the next group of combatants. Cora, on the other hand, was faring better than Boxy had been expecting. The fiend had already stomped 3 of her assailants flat and was currently chasing down the last. Her body was riddled with wounds from all the hits she had taken, but she appeared to still be going strong. She hadn't even used her second wind skill yet, which would provide her with an instantaneous burst of HP should the need arise. Still, it created another mirror image to watch her back all the same. Chaotic energies swirl around you. Your MP has been depleted.
Ha!
The ceiling-bound monster nearly fell to the ground when its chaotic disposition triggered dangerously. Even though it had mountains of HP, its MP was arguably just as vital a resource. Thankfully, it wasn't in any immediate danger as the dwarves on the ground were far too busy dealing with its copies and its minions. After several seconds, it had recovered enough to open its storage and take out a few mana potions, which it immediately consumed to restore 600 of its MP. Just in time, too, as Boxy spotted a troop of 10 or so fully armed and armored dwarves pouring in from one of the side chambers. It reopened its pocket dimension and withdrew two of the big bang balls it had prepared in advance, triggering the spell crystals and tossing them into the pack of dwarves. The resulting high-powered magical explosions turned the Honeydew Cartel's reinforcements into a fine red paste before they could even react. Level up! Congratulations! You are now a level 35 warlock. Intelligence plus 2. Mental fortitude plus 2. Endurance plus 2. Wasting no time, Boxy dropped to the ground and skittered through the same door from which the apparent reinforcements had come. This appeared to be a sort of armory, the walls lined with weapons and armor sets. Several of the slower dwarves were still gearing up, but it had no intention of allowing them to finish. It dashed through the room, slitting throats and severing spines with every movement of its dagger-wielding tentacles. Once they had all been dealt with, it quickly gobbled up the corpses and returned to the main chamber, where the battle had already ended. On the whole, it was another relatively easy victory, just as Boxy had anticipated. Except for that speed bump where it had lost nearly all of its MP due to an unlucky chaotic disposition. It wondered if one of these days it might not just hit a "Your HP has been depleted" notification and simply die on the spot. No, that probably wouldn't happen. Surely even the whimsical god of happenstance wouldn't give his hero a skill that would outright kill it. On second thought, that was exactly the kind of thing that Wilberforce would do. Knowing him, there was probably an incredibly tiny chance that would bring him no small measure of entertainment should it actually happen. Then again, chaotic disposition's effects were always temporary, so maybe instant suicide couldn't be part of the deal. Boxy hastily decided that the latter possibility was more probable and that there was really nothing to worry about, though it would look into ways to control or stifle the ability. Just in case. It shifted its attention to the remnants of the criminal organization that it had just dismantled. Three of the dwarves were still alive and were currently being restrained by Cora, just as her master had instructed. 30 or so corpses were strewn about the area, and a quick check-in with Zira revealed that only two of the dwarves had tried to run and been summarily burned to ash. The other entrance appeared to still be sealed shut, so it didn't seem as though any witnesses had escaped. In short, the underground compound was now under its complete control. Boxy instructed Cora and Fizzy to keep an eye on the three captives to make sure that they didn't die just yet, then quickly searched all the rooms at the edge of the large chamber for noteworthy loot. Other than the armory, there was a warehouse containing a number of unmarked crates, a well-stocked pantry brimming with fresh food and good drink, and several sleeping commons that held beds for at least 80 people. That last one was a bit worrying, as it likely meant that there were still quite a few of the cartel people on the outside doing drug runs. Or whatever it was they did. Boxy didn't fret too much, though. It was planning to leave town once it was done with this place anyway, so a few rats still scurrying about were of no real concern. It had tracked down and assassinated Grimebeard before commencing its attack, so it really had no reason to stick around once it had wrapped things up here. And thus, the warehouse was looted. The food in the pantry devoured, the corpses diligently absorbed or eaten, and anything else of value stolen. Overall, the haul was a rather disappointing 2,400 GP worth of coins and valuables, much lower than the haul it had gotten from the Koran massacre. Still, Boxy had been able to get in a lot of infiltration practice, and its storage was filled with a number of interesting substances, so it was hardly a bad day. Actually, wasn't its day going almost too smoothly? The last time it had had so much good fortune in a single day, it had been captured, imprisoned, and had its warlock job taken by force. Fearing a backswing of bad luck, Boxy stopped wasting time and moved on to the last thing it would need to do in the Lodrak Empire, Right here, on the edge of town, it would perform a certain demonic ritual. That was why it had been so adamant about keeping a few of the dwarves alive. The ritual demanded a sacrifice of 3 lives. The ceremony itself was a bit complicated since it involved a bunch of dancing in addition to the weird chanting and squiggly blood sigils, but Boxy was confident that it could pull it off. This would hardly be its first time performing the sort of ritual, after all. The tricky part was making sure that it had a clear escape route before performing the offering to Leosora. Part 7. The door leading onto the roof of the restaurant known as the Cracked Flagon flung open, and a figure stepped out into the night. Boxy surveyed the town from its reasonably high vantage point, noting that it had gone almost entirely dark. Unsurprising, considering that the sun had already set hours ago. Dealing with the Honeydew Cartel to a satisfyingly thorough degree had taken longer than expected, not only infiltrating and exterminating them, but also ransacking their hideout beneath the dining establishment.